There is innocence refound. There also is the radicalization of the urban structure, airport included. This new innocence is actually as old as the first hiatus of life, 2 or 3 billion years ago, when swiftness was discovered as synonymous with, or at least indispensable to, life. But swiftness is only fitness, or to be more precise, fitness is organized swiftness. The swift traveler, not the hurried traveler, is the only contented traveler. Then, the relatively swift plane passenger configuration must not land itself into this semi-living airport with its diaspora monster of a problem, the city included, not even yet acknowledged. The truth of the matter is that we have an ebullient propensity for adding bottlenecks inside of bottlenecks and calling the result a product of affluence. On the subject in question, the primary bottlenecks are the connection of the city to the airport itself, and the secondary bottlenecks are the ticket counter, the luggage counter, and the door to the airplane. Of these five, only the last is necessary and acceptable. But the ability to get rid of the other four is in the new innocence suggested above. The new innocence, to use another analogy, is when and where mankind's piece fits into the puzzle of the cosmos. If man happens, and it would not be by accident, to coincide with himself in the philia that ought to be, then the puny problem of the airport will fuse itself into the problem of society with millions of others. If not, then it will remain with man as one of the minor headaches of his confused species. Before coming to the constructive part of my proposition, it might be well to face the concept of the usual and the unusual. If by way of illustration, we take an animal, cut it open, and observe. Our confidence in what we consider to be usual or natural is shaken. It is a bloody congestion we watch there, nothing polite or urbane about it. That's a hell of a creature twitching, a universe furiously in pursuit, trying to survive, brutally single-minded, awesomely secretive and complex. Indeed, a most remote stranger to behold. Yet that is what we are, each of us, biological organisms. And we know we are but strangers to ourselves. We know what we know of what we are is literally skin deep, and our brain contortions float somewhere out in the cold. We know but an abstraction of ourselves, and we are despondently and disproportionately inclined to live by it. All this is to point out that the familiar proposition is not necessarily true, and that the shock of revelation ought not by itself to alert one of the presence of the absurd. At a first glance, much that is not of our consciousness shocks as absurd, and we are quick at rejection. It is almost as automatic as the biological rejection of an organ transplanted that we observe in medicine. I am conceptually introducing, and not too gently either, into the urban body, the city terminal, a semi-solid block of furiously driven events, a sanguine and animal turmoil, covertly disciplined and multi-directed. The para-animal we call society falls under the rigor and the rules of the biological, for both are of the same universe, and both the biological animal, achiever of incredible complexity, and society, which is oriented towards increasingly more and more complex forms of complexity, are complexity-driven. A careful look at the nature of complexity will show that it is welded to the process of miniaturization. Complexity is an increment of coordinated activities happening in contracting spaces. As there is no complexification that does not coincidentally involve contraction, so there is no city without a corresponding miniaturization of the physical structure that supports it. It is here that the new level of innocence bids farewell to the romantic notion that man and soil must mingle in an inexhaustible embrace. Nature man and creator man, with all the cohorts of middle and average man, are moving away from the soil, if hardly closer to that hypothetical kingdom of compassion and grace that I like to call the aesthetogenesis of matter. A kingdom not in opposition to nature, but constructing itself into its own transcendent nature. That is to say, the nature of man does not dwell in the gilded hamlets of home and garden, but is thrust in that same unfamiliar and frightful turbulence we discover within the contented skin of every organism. Contented because successful. But this success is carried by an enormously rigorous discipline guided by omnipresent rules. It is actually a miracle that perpetuates itself, a triple miracle of consolidation, reiteration, and progression. Not, as one can see, the stuff suburbia and megalopoly are made of, but the only stuff that can stand and can spell the stresses of life's genesis. The case of the airport is becoming a glaring example of insular nonsense. One's purpose and instrumentality becoming consequential, the solution is automatically out of sight. It is instead historically right that once a technique, in this case air transportation, has been proven as sound, it be incorporated in the fabric of reality in the most coherent manner possible, letting go from itself those parts that happen to be of no more use. In the case of air transportation, the airport, as an autonomous and physically isolated system, has seen its day. If this is so, it must go. The sooner the better. Mr. Soleri will now show some slides to elaborate and illustrate this material.
I'm showing some of the of the schemes that I hope will illustrate the paper. This first one is a very theoretical diagram showing that the city takes the place of the terminal. And in this case, the landing facilities are suggested as a continuous ring around the city. This is the same diagram. this was designed for New Jersey, the Meadows. And the city, which was the airport, becomes a 1 million population urban center. And according to the land system, we have the landing strips surrounding the city, and then the access to a unloading runway in here, taxiing. So you arrive or you leave from the city directly into what we used to call the airport. So this takes the place of the airport itself, becomes the center where most of the people would come and go from. Your landing strip would surround the city, and then you would have the vertical takeoff and vertical landing on top of the city. This indicates the development of the ground level and underground level where the industry would develop. This was another site in New Jersey illustrating the same idea. Can you focus on that? This was a little model of this concept. You see the taxiing in here, flanked by the industrial plants, And you had the taxing with the freight loading and unloading on this side, and the loading and unloading of people on this side. From here into to the core of the city would take only a few minutes. On top of the industrial system are parks and gardens. This is an elevation of the same structure. In the section, you can see the taxiing space. So the airplane, the air carrier would come in from the landing strips, come in here, load and unload, be serviced and so on. And the passengers would be directly connected with the urban center. Industries, loading and unloading. I'm not going into the organization of the city because this is not the point of the symposium. We are making a large model of the whole land and urban organization. This was a mock-up of this model. This is the new model we are working on. Very briefly, this section, which is the midsection of the city, is all the space related to the urban life, commerce, leisure, culture, and so on. And those systems are dwelling, basically. Those are neighborhood levels, dwelling systems, the city center itself. In this thickness is the urban life. Here is the private life here and there. This develops into a full circular organization. Those are other examples of clustered systems, which would again incorporate landing facilities, in this case, vertical landing facilities within the city itself. This is a much smaller scheme and would have landing, vertical landing and vertical takeoff from the top of one of those columns. This is about 30,000 population. The one before was about 250,000. And there are cutouts to show the inside. This is another one of about 300,000, and there again I'm showing a a vertical takeoff airport, let's call it. This is the same structure. This is the airport. This is another one. And this is again the landing facilities on top of the city. This is about 1 kilometer inside. It's a cube and of about 400,000 population. One kilometer inside, and that's the airport. The inside of it. Another example with, again, vertical system of takeoff and landing. This is a dam which is also an urban center with the again, airport on this platform. The same in front view. And finally, here is a concept of an urban river. This is a section of a system that would develop for hundreds or thousands of miles. And you have your urban life organized on the sides of this main structure, which is mainly transportation and industries. And on top of this structure, you have an endless airport, in the sense that you can land at any position in any section of this urban system, possibly every 100 miles or 200 miles or so, and serve directly the urban life and the productive life. So everything would be so organized as to be a few minutes away from anything else. So this, as I can see it, is really the most efficient approach to organizing life and logistics in one continuous system. I think that's it.
It's with great delight that we invite you to the podium to invite you to focus on the aviation environment, particularly in the light of the urban structure. Mr. McCart.
Thank you, Mr. Becky. Ladies and gentlemen, an expert is defined not as a man from out of town, but a man who makes no little mistakes in his way to a celestial blunder. And for me, the best way of making a celestial blunder would be to talk about aviation. I only have the normal experiences of an American citizen, such as I had today, spending quite a long time, an hour, in the end of the runway at Salt Lake City, or the night before when I made two unsuccessful attempts to go from Portland to Eugene, Oregon. Everything that brilliant man, Soleri, has said, I think, evokes a response from me. I think airports are places one would rather not be in. Airplanes are vehicles which are occupied by shoe salesmen. Glamour is something which has never entered an airplane in spite of stewardesses or an airport. I think the only observation I have to make about aviation before I talk about the subject I care about, which, however, has some relevance, I think, to your preoccupations, is that by and large, aviation has given itself over to the concept that the speed of the trip is rather more important than the quality of the trip. And I would say that that is a very adolescent view that older men have always realized, of course, that the quality of the experience is rather more important than the speed of the trip. All right? So what I'm now going to talk about is ecological planning. I suspect engineers and people engaged in almost all activities knew until recently nothing about ecology at all, and they assumed their God-given right to destroy nature for private greed, benefit, and malice, and did so with all joy and great expedition. As a result of Luna Leopold and the Dade County Airport, people in aviation have now begun to understand that ecology is something that's rather important, and I believe the SST, our final aeronautic idiocy, will lead us into understanding the stratosphere before we emulate the activities which Krakatoa was able to do. I think we had 2 years of gloom in the world and 2 years without harvests as a result of the particulate matter which Krakatoa put into the stratosphere. Lamont Cole, the ecologist at Cornell, believes that this can be accomplished by 80 SSTs. And this would be a final cumulation in idiocy. This would be an aeronautic first, without doubt. I have water here. Well, because you really have to know about ecology whether you want to or not, and I am a man who stands halfway between you and ecologists. That is, I'm a recent convert. I'm not a biological scientist, but I consume them and have learned from them. And I make an enormous amount of income relative to me, that is, a man who has so long lived in ignominy and poverty. I make a fair amount chastising the likes of you, of income out of all those who have a strong feeling of guilt about what you've been doing to the environment, or if you don't have it, should have. So I will talk now on the general subject of ecology, and ecology is a basis for planning. And because I've got to pump up some adrenaline, I will tell some stories which I need in order to pump up some adrenaline. The first story, I use these mercilessly, and if anybody can get me better ones, I'll replace the present ones with the ones you tell me. For a moment. The first story is an image conceived by Lauren Isley, a great cultural anthropologist at the University of Pennsylvania. Isley realized that man was about to infest space, and he conceived at that time when man from space would be able to look from this distant vantage at the Earth. This man in space, this then hypothetical man in space, was able to see the Earth from this great distance, see this small rotating orb. He perceived it was green, green from the maritime algae in the oceans, green from verdure on land. He perceived the Earth really was covered by a green biosphere. It was indeed a green celestial fruit. And as he looked at it more closely, he perceived that on this green celestial fruit, our home, on the biosphere, there were blemishes, necrotic, pathological tissue, brown, black, gray, and from these extended dynamic tentacles, he perceived that blemishes upon the world life epidermis were in fact the cities and works of man, and asked, is man but a planetary disease? And I think the conclusion is, if you were a planetary doctor from far out in space, looking about the on the Earth and seeing that one species was multiplying itself at an exponential rate, and not only extirpating other species, but extirpating the environment which was essential for its own survival, you would conclude indeed that man was a planetary disease. But if you looked at it a little bit more closely, one would also wish, of course, for a sort of celestial penicillin, which one could dust upon the particular planetary diseases and vaporize them, let's say. But it's important to recognize that not all men are co-equally planetary diseases. The Defense Department is almost totally, I would say, composed of planetary disease. All these people who have given themselves over to intercontinental ballistic missiles, and who are these putrescent people who are concerned with pneumococci and anthrax and agents of biochemical warfare. These men may very well wake up in the morning, wash, shave, dress, put, you know, brush their teeth and put deodorant under their armpits, but they're deluding nobody. They are, in fact, not men. They are ambulant pathological disease disguised as men. Their wives should not admit them to bed. Their children shouldn't kiss them. Their friends shouldn't greet them. Their ministers, rabbis, and priests should excoriate them. They should be reviled and persecuted. However, I think I don't want to dwell on this particularly, but merely to induce an appropriate sense of guilt where it properly reposes. If you have any reason for guilt, by all means, accept it, and I will give you some more. As a man who was born a Presbyterian, I learned a fundamental lesson, that is, the audience must have a profound sense of guilt before it will move towards salvation. And as we know, written on the wall, it's not many, many take up harsh, and it says, ecology, 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 truth. There we are. Planetary diseaseism. All of the atomic warfare people, biochemical warfare people, the napalm devoliation people, the Dow chemicals, Montrose chemicals, all of the rain of death, putrescent disease types disguised as men. And of course our great great corporations whose products may be household words, but who are not yet toilet trained, certainly fall in this category too, not least of course the great polluters of Detroit. All of these are, without doubt, to some degree or other, planetary diseases. All right, the next story is my own, bred from introspection on the proliferation of nuclear power and the specter this presents. In my nightmare, some white-coated, sepulchral, non-combatant warrior has decided that some temporary human squabble between some miscalled great powers can be resolved atomically. And in a nightmare, he resolves it atomically, and so the Earth is covered with a rain of atomic weapons which extirpate all life, save in one deep leaden slit where long inured to radiation persists a small colony of algae, these little unicellular plants, and they perceive that all life has been extirpated save they, and the whole business of evolution, of mutation, cooperation, competition, adaptation, 2.5 billion years of this must ensue at least in order to recover only yesterday, and they come to an immediate, spontaneous, and unanimous conclusion, next time, no brains. It's not an idle discussion, this matter of brains, because we believe, of course, that man is justified by brains, that man is, in fact, man brain. Everything from a neck up is splendid and justifies us. Everything from a neck down is faintly sweaty, hairy, carnal, sinful. And the proper function of brain is for brain to subjugate, dominate this carnal, sweaty, glandular lower part, which is, of course, essentially Judaism and Christianity. And that this has been extended to assume that man-brain has exactly the same role to carnal, sweaty, glandular nature. And the role of man, man-brain, is in fact to conquer and subjugate nature. So that if one wants to understand the enormous despoliation which is the fruits of Western man's work over 2,500 years of time, then one can understand it beautifully in terms of the explicit creation story absorbed by Judaism, Christianity, and humanism, which simply says that man is exclusively divine, everything else is rubbish. There's a hierarchy with man at the pinnacle, God, the archangels, and man, and then the sort of dandruff falls below. man is exclusively divine. He's given dominion over life and non-life. Dominion, this is not a term for negotiation. There's no discussion about dominion. Lie down is dominion. It's a sergeant major's view of the universe. Man is a sergeant major, and everything will bow down before him. And, of course, if you have any doubt about this text, then the third line absolutely concludes. It says that man is licensed to subjugate the earth. And if you want to find a text for the non-combatant extirpator of all life, the man who wants to make atomic harbors with Alaskan harbors with atomic bombs or Panama canals, or simply drive a bulldozer, you have, in fact, the perfect text here. If you want to see the reason, if you want to find the text which has motivated the destruction accomplished by Western man in all time, that is a text. And if you want to see what the operative verb of Western man is towards nature, you find it. It is, in fact, conquest, dominion, and subjugation. And, of course, brains are the instrument of conquest, dominion, and subjugation. We have got to see that this is a madness, that there is no conception of a man, with an ambulant brain. One has to have the area from the neck down, and I am so glad we do. There is no conception of man without nature. Man is, in fact, profoundly natural. This conception, which is our view of nature, is the basis for our conquest, which really finally can only involve our self-mutilation and our self-destruction. It is a view of man and nature which must be eliminated, because it has no adaptive value at all, but even worse, it's an absolute guarantee of our extinction. Our extinction will result from men who believe that they are exclusively divine, that nature, is not protected by God, that man's role is to dominate nature and to subjugate it. And if you want the metaphysical symbol for Western man's view to nature, you can see it very explicitly in the Garden of Versailles. I suggest to you this best represents our view of man and nature, man, God, and nature, the best symbol that has ever been created. Consider it. This garden took half the treasury of France during the life of Louis XIV to make. The main axis was a mile and a half long. The cross axis is half a mile wide. The two axes come together at the Palace of Versailles, which the purpose of which is only to represent this conjunction. At the axes in the Palace of Versailles is the bedroom of Louis XIV. At the axes in the bedroom is, in fact, the bed of Louis XIV. And on the bed lies Louis XIV, king, remember, by divine right, lying transected, you see, by these twin axes, with all nature, docile, tractable plants gathered into an embroidery pattern lying before him, symbolizing his divinity, symbolizing and representing his dominion over nature and his success in subjugating it. He, Louis XIV, lying in his bed, regretting profoundly the fact that it was not entirely symmetrical.